Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Martin Amis's latest, The Zone of Interest, provides a searing portrait of life, shockingly love, in a concentration camp. In the novel, the stories of the commander of the camp, the nephew of Hitler's secretary, and a prisoner at the camp all converge. Amis is the author of 13 previous novels, most recently Lionel Asbo, The Memoir Experience, two collections of stories, and six works of nonfiction. It is a great pleasure to welcome Martin Amis back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure.
You have been getting amazing reviews for this book, and some calling it your greatest achievement as a writer. I ask that only as a question to you because I wonder how you view that, and do you look at this as some of your finest writing?
Well, it's a risky kind of question to ask yourself. Anthony Burgess, when he was asked what his favorite novel was of his own corpus, said the next one. And I think that's quite a good balanced reply. Also, you don't have favorites among your novels because it would be like having a favorite among your children. So you resist that.
But are you proud of the work and the story you were able to tell?
Yeah, I think I was amazed by how it did seem to fall into place. You start a novel with one image or one character, one situation, and all I had as a prompt, as a donné, was what's on the first page of this novel, which is a sort of love at first sight moment against a macabre background. The only detail that suggests this is no ordinary background is when he says of the loved one or the admired one that she sort of disappeared past the three-wheel gallows. But everything else in the scene is completely Arcadian, normal. So, and that's all I had, and I began, and then I thought, well, it'd be good to have the commandant have his own narration, and also the leader of the Sonderkommando, the Jewish prisoners who were the undertakers of Auschwitz, who the most degraded people in the history of humanity. They had to do all the work with the corpses, with the shears and the dental work and the processing of the bodies, the grinding of the bones, etc., etc.
You wrote in your memoir about your first visit to Auschwitz in the late 1990s. And then, of course, you wrote about a concentration camp in Time's Arrow. Was it always something that you thought you would explore again?
I never thought I would explore it once until I wrote Time's Arrow. Then I do seem to be attracted as a writer to this subject. And I wrote a novel about the Gulag called House of Meetings, and I felt I still had unfinished business and will always have unfinished business with the Third Reich. And I say always because the remarkable thing, never been commented on as far as I can see, is that that no one understands what Hitler was up to. There's no comparable astonishment when looking at the careers of Stalin or even Mao. But no historian claims to understand Hitler, and we don't understand him. It's a black hole, and for that reason, I could well imagine or well conceive of writing a third novel on this subject.
So, is this an exploration to try to understand that, or to try to understand the people who were put in that circumstance of a concentration camp?
Well, only in as much as you can't write about them without you know, seeming to illuminate their mental universe. But it was actually when I stopped worrying about the why that I felt free to write the book. And it was a epiphanic paragraph of Primo Levi, where he was asked if he understood the Nazi hatred. And he said, perhaps one should not understand it. Our duty is not to understand it, because to understand something is to contain it, to identify with its author. And no one can do, no normal human being can do that. And he said, the Nazi hatred is anti-human, really counter-human. It is a hatred that is not in us. It is outside man. Now, when I read that, and he said, there's a sort of comfort in that, that you would have to be, you'd have to be sick, really, to understand it, or to imagine you understood it. And when I could cease to torment myself with the question why, then I was somehow free. I don't think we ever will find out a why. And most commentators agree.
So in that freeing, you're allowed to explore things like love and even the humor of the situation.
Well, I very much sort of resent or suspicious of that word humor, in that, and I can't bear it when this novel was called an office comedy, the trivializing effect of that. But I would stress that laughter is not just, you know, high spirits. It's not just frivolity laughter. Laughter is a very versatile human response, and we laugh out of disgust, contempt, self-loathing. There are various very serious registers that that laughter works on, and there's a resilient misconception that once humor is admitted into a novel, that it chases out seriousness. A very humorless notion, in my view.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, it is part of a writer's armory. And I think I agree with Nabokov when he said that all writers who are any good are funny. And I think this goes for the whole English tradition and the Russian tradition and the French tradition, that, you know, Dostoevsky, people think of as really grim and seething. He's very funny. So is Gogol. So is Tolstoy. So is Zamyatin and all the 20th century Russian writers. It is a comic tradition. Novels are comic. Throughout the British, you know, Jane Austen, etc., to Dickens and beyond. And there's a reason for that, is that life is comic up to a point. I very much didn't want to have a sort of sepulchral, solemn voice, although the Sonderkommando narration is occasionally that. That idea that you have to, you know, bleach your prose of anything of beauty or of humor in order to answer to the seriousness of the situation you're describing. I mean, I think there are great responsibilities when you write fiction about the Holocaust or about the Gulag. I don't think anything goes. I very much disliked that film, Life is Beautiful, although I admire Art Spiegelman, his Maus books. I think, you know, he takes a big chance, but he brings it off. And it's like any kind of writing. You have to earn it. And it's a complicated notion, that, but all writers will understand what I mean, is you can't just toss these propositions onto the page. You have to sort of suffer and writhe before you've got the right to do that.
I was struck by what you just said in humor being in the armory of a writer. because when I asked you the initial question, I was struck that in that freeing process of once you stop asking the why, that you are allowed to basically look at the palette in front of you, which is human emotion, and of course love and humor and anxiety and fear, all of those are part of that.
Yeah. Yes, and you know, I think why I'm attracted to extremes is because there's a sense in which you do. The survivors, in their testimonies, they say again and again that you don't see more than 2 or 3% of any human being until the situation becomes very extreme, and then you find out who you are, and you find out who others are. And in normal life, in peaceful, civilized life, you don't need to see more than 5% of another human being, and you don't need to see more than 5% of yourself. But when you're in an atrocity-producing situation, as they all are, then you know, the deepest sources of your being become apparent, and that fascinates me.
Well, there is a violence that is inherent in the telling of the story. It is not an overly violent story.
Overly violent. Mm. Well, there's a sort of great deal of suppressed,
right.
And there's a great deal of pressure of death in the air. But I don't. There are one or two very violent episodes, and cruel episodes. But I wanted to avoid what Primo Levi called literary lechery, where a certain kind of writer gets hold of this subject and is, you know, horribly excited by it. And I don't think I was that. I mean, it was a fascinating book to write because one of the characters, the commandant, is very evil. And, you know, they talk about the banality of evil. The answer to that is that they might well have been banal at the beginning of the process, but once they'd started this death cult, they ceased to be banal at that point. And I had to sort of fall into a kind of reverie and try and imagine his thoughts and explore my own talent for evil. And that was very alarming. And I would think, oh God, I found an even more despicable thing for him to do. So it was like communing with your own devil. Fascinating.
Absolutely. Martin Amis is our guest on the book show this week. The novel is The Zone of Interest, and it's published by Knopf. I'm hoping you can read a short passage from the novel. It comes later on in, and you can set it up of one of the characters talking about nightmares.
Yes, this is the Sonderkommando Führer, Schmuel, the Polish prisoner, Jewish prisoner who has become the undertaker of the lager. I used to have the greatest respect for nightmares, for their intelligence and artistry. Now I think nightmares are pathetic. They are quite incapable of coming up with anything even remotely as terrible as what I do all day, and they've stopped trying. Now I just dream about cleanliness and food.
Did you think about what the ramifications were for this character of I think you alluded to this earlier, about wanting to know their depths and how they thought. And of course nightmares would be part of that fear and not knowing what tomorrow would bring.
Yes, well, I mean, it's the situation of the Sonder, the special battalion, was very, I mean, can have no precedent in human history, I don't think, because they're offered this job and all they get out of it, they get better rations and they get some alcohol and some tobacco, but it's made quite clear that they're only going to delay their death, and perhaps only by a couple of weeks. And their first duty as a Sonder is to cremate your predecessors. So it couldn't be more contingent and couldn't be more humiliating and disgusting, the job. And that peculiarity of the Nazi filth was that they would make, it wasn't enough to have victims. You had to conscript people into your own effort. So they smeared you with their own evil. And, he is helping the Nazi war machine. He's making the extermination more efficient. He knows about the physics of the pyres. He knows how to process the bodies. He knows how to use human fat as a way of making the whole body ignite. Real expertise in the service of Germany. And that's the essence of the humiliation in this case.
And he is allowed, I believe you use the term of bearing witness and to even save lives as a sliver of redemption, I guess.
Well, when Primo Levi wrote a terrific essay about the Sonders, he said he didn't know what I subsequently found out, is that they did occasionally save a life. They would say in Yiddish to young men, they would say, "You are 18 years old and you have a trade." Meaning when they ask you, when you come for the selection, right is to live, 90% went left and weren't even tattooed and were dead within an hour of arriving in Auschwitz. But if you say that, you've got a chance. And I think that tips the moral balance decisively towards leniency when you think about the Sonders, that they did save a life. And even without that, you cannot point the finger at them unless you've had to make a comparable choice. That is the lesson.
You spoke a moment ago about the responsibility in writing a novel about the Holocaust, and specifically about writing a novel in a concentration camp. Were you challenged by those restrictions at all?
Well, it was my second time, so I did all the foundational suffering the first time, and have read so much since then that, and the reading, it takes a lot out of you. I mean, you suffer every page you read about it. So I felt I had earned it and paid my dues, and that there would be moments of great doubt. But that's, as Keats said, the poet, that's what writers manage to, get through. They have negative capability. They're able to go on despite severe doubt. And so I had the usual severe doubts, but I felt I'd paid my dues emotionally before I began.
Did you always want there to be a love story?
Yes, that was the donné, was that it would be a love story against a macabre background.
Were there moments where you thought, how does this advance, because it's rather hopeless just in its setup, isn't it?
Completely hopeless, and nothing ever comes of it. One of the memoirs I read was about someone who was a child, schoolboy during the First World War, and then lived through Hitler's seizure of power and got out of Germany in 1938. And he said the process of, when Hitler picked up the keys to the chancellery, there was a feeling not just of horror and dread, but of complete unreality. Everything looked ersatz, shockingly dreamlike. But then he described what it was like living under the Third Reich, and he said that you know, every week you would say goodbye to a feeling. You would say, oh, I can't entertain that kind of delicate thought, that kind of romantic feeling anymore. I've got to let it go. You just said to yourself all the time, let it go. And the lines of an Auden poem that he quotes say it all. He said, saying alas to less and less. You harden yourself. And then in Auschwitz, when he sees the commandant's wife sleeping in a sort of bus shelter by herself, and he stares at her for an hour while she's sleeping, and he feels all those emotions that he's dismissed and cancelled coming back to him. And that was very important in my conception of the novel.
You were speaking a moment ago about in the research of reading and in doing that research and feeling emotional and drained as you're reading these stories. So at the conclusion of the novel, is there a point where you say, my next project is going to just by nature be lighter?
By nature?
Be lighter. Be something that is not as emotionally draining.
Yes. Well, you could hardly. There's nothing comparable to
right.
this phase of events. But I find that these preoccupations don't go away, and I'm writing an autobiographical novel. But where I say that I was born 4 years after the death of Hitler and 4 years before the death of Stalin. And these are the imagos of my imagination. These are the great genies that overshadowed my childhood and my life. You never know where these preoccupations come from. I had one conversation with my mother when I was about eight, and I said, I'd seen some images of the smokestacks and the rail tracks, and I said, Mom, what was all that with Hitler and those people and the starving people? And I was clearly disturbed by this, and my mother said, oh, don't worry about Hitler, she said. You've got blonde hair and blue eyes. Hitler would have loved you. And I felt sort of ignoble relief and sort of skulked off. But I wonder if the idea of Hitler loving me had started some emotional theme in my head or in my unconscious.
Did your father have that theme at all, do you think, of dealing with this, with these issues?
Well, he was in the war. He was in the Signals Corps. He's an undergraduate, and in his third year at university, he was, you know, officer training, and he was in Belgium, France, and he saw plenty of dead bodies. So he was as committed as you could be, and I think it would have been, you're always asking yourself, what would I have done? But I certainly know that if I'd been 20 years old in 1939, I would have very happily enlisted. And Evelyn Waugh describes it in his Sword of Honor trilogy. He said, there was the enemy, you know, huge and ugly, but it was clear. There was no ambiguity about it. And you knew that that was the fight of your generation. And how could you resist that? I mean, it was... Never before has there been such lack of ambiguity about which was the moral side to be on.
Martin Amis's new novel was The Zone of Interest. It is published by Knauf. Martin Amis, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to Paul Ruest for his support. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.